Stoveleg Media, igniting conversation.
We are thrilled to be joined once again by former prosecutor, now crime television personality, Jarrett Ferrantino. Thanks for hanging out with us again. It's been a little too long.
It's been way too long, guys. It took a snowstorm that blanketed half the country to get back on the show. I'm snowed in tonight, and I was looking forward all day. I said, I got to do that show tonight. At least we have something going on, right?
Man, I've been pumped about it too. And honestly, while we were recording this episode, I was like, we just got to call Jarrett like right now because this is wild and I want to talk to him about it.
Yeah. And of course, we're going to jump into the Robert Garrow case, the Placid Lake murders, and just all kinds of legal questions because these things kept coming up as we were going over it. And it just was mind blowing to us. But as you shared with us off the air, it's a very familiar case that's taught in law schools, and I don't know, curious to get the take of a person that's involved in it. And then a little later we're going to talk about a new book you've got coming out with some cases that we have discussed with you in the past, but I want to end on that so everybody can remember the call to action and go hit that pre-order button. Does that sound all right?
Great. Sure. I mean, the Robert Garrow case is taught. And so your listeners and fans know the case, and the case is taught in law school. It's known as the buried bodies case.
Okay. Like, yep.
First of all, it's nice when your case gets a name. You don't want to be the buried bodies guy, right? So yeah. That's what it is. It's known as the buried body case, not necessarily because Garrow buried his bodies, the victims, bodies of his victims. It's known because his lawyers, Frank Armani and Francis Belge, knew where some of the remains of his victims were. And it literally created a battle between Belge and Armani's duty of confidentiality versus the administration and interests of justice. That's what this thing set off. So you have this in the courts, they love to balance rights. So you have the constitutional right of your Fifth Amendment right and your Sixth Amendment right to counsel, right? So you got two constitutional amendments here versus, some would say, common sense and decency, public health, all this stuff. But the gist of it is, Garrow tells his lawyers where these bodies are. His lawyers are not only aware of this fact through Garrow, they go there and find the bodies, map this thing out, and then can't tell authorities. And families are looking for answers on these bodies. Families are looking for answers for their loved ones. And here are these lawyers who sit in the center and know. That's what this case, as shocking as Garrow's life and his crimes were, this stands for the legal proposition of the extremes of the attorney-client privilege. That's what the Garrow case is, really why it gets discussed at such great length.
Can you help me remember why did he tell these attorneys this information in hopes of obtaining a plea deal?
From what I can gather and what I understand, he was building his insanity defense. So when you say you're insane, you acknowledge you committed the crimes. Mm-hmm. But when his lawyers are assessing the level of insanity, they're saying, Robert, what else did you do? And he says, I happen to kill these other people. I'll prove it to you. Here's where their bodies are at. So it's significant because here's what I would have done in this situation. So let's carry it out. This thing plays out in the courts. It becomes widely known that his lawyers knew where these bodies were in the presentation of the insanity defense in his case. The families, the public are outraged. Belge was arrested and charged with a public decency law, public health law violation, saying, you went and knew where a body was improperly disposed of, and you covered it up. Essentially, you covered up a crime. You're guilty of a crime, and that's why he was charged. That case was what put the horns of attorney-client privilege versus these decency laws head-to-head. And the attorney the right to attorney client privilege and the right to confidentiality carried the day. His case was dismissed, and the extremes of that confidentiality were tested.
So that's, in my mind, Jarrett, insane.
I was about to say, we're not going to show you our hand, but here is John showing you all of our cards. Yeah,
I don't have a great poker face.
You believe he was, right? Well, here's what you have to understand. And like, if that was my loved one, I'd go bananas, right? Yeah. It'd be like Rambo was on the loose, you know, mm-hmm. The city'd be on fire. I'd be looking at, but here's what you have to understand here and or should try to understand. You don't have to, obviously, but the right to counsel is so paramount in the eyes of the law that this free communication and open communication with your lawyer is so important that it has to work in the extreme scenario. There are very limited exceptions to that privilege. One of them is, are you able to prevent a future harm to mm-hmm. someone? So one could look at this and say, hey, these victims ain't getting any deader, right?
Right.
But guess what? This offends all decency. Mm-hmm. And then, or what about the emotional harm on these families? You know, you're waiting. They were inevitably discovered months later by accident, okay? Not because anybody came forward. So are we only talking about physical harm? What about the emotional toll? The fact that you're holding your cards on this information takes on a family. So my thought on, as crazy as this is the extremes of the attorney-client privilege, and it has to work in the extremes for it to truly be a privilege. And that's the reality. And the public didn't like it, and it was tested through the courts, and it withstand the scrutiny. These guys never really recovered, though, Belgium and Monty. I mean, it really impacted them. You know, they went from being appointed to, I think Armani got the case first and brought Belge in. So he had to be grateful for that, right?
Right. Who needs friends or who needs enemies when you have friends like that? So this is coming from veteran attorney Ferrantino. Can you recall in law school, maybe when you first heard this, did you have the same feeling or is this something that, I don't know, almost a turning point for a lot of law students where they're like, oh, this confidentiality piece is for real. It's not just lip service of some kind.
I think that's where and when I say it has to work in the extremes, the extreme example is what just teaches the lesson of how critical this is. It's like that priest privilege. Like you could admit to killing somebody to a priest and they don't have to, they're not to reveal that information, right? Mm-hmm. And that's how you feel sometimes. You know, we're counselors too. You hear information that will not make its way to the public. Now, here's what I think. Here's what I would have done if I was in those shoes. I hope that was your next question, John.
Going to be.
Okay.
So, perfect.
So I wouldn't violate the privilege because there'd be hell to pay if I did. I'd be violating the law. However, if Garrow's case is essentially a plea, he's acknowledging he did this, I tell Garrow, look, we don't lose a step in our ability to maintain that you're insane if we come forward and show these families where the bodies are. In fact, that may go a long way in us representing you, maybe getting you a fair shake on the insanity plea. I don't see how it drove their defense at all. Mm-hmm. If Garrow was willing to tell them and was smart enough to say, this may help my insanity defense, why couldn't they talk him into telling where these bodies were? I know he wasn't charged with these particular cases at the time, but Garrow knew, I'm going to admit, he was admitting to killing the male camper in the killing in that case, right, Philip? Mm-hmm. Isn't that what he was on trial for?
Yes.
Three kids survived, so he was looking at 25 to life. You say, Robert, all right, you get deemed insane, you're gone for life anyway. Let's just bring this out and bring it to the prosecutor. I don't know that they had that conversation. I hope they had. But Garrow really has no reason to say no to that.
And here's the – John and I differ to some degree. I'm with him on – well, okay, let me say this. I am on board with if he told them I did this, it is their job to keep that confidential. I can wrap my mind around that. Them going to the bodies – is where I feel like that may cross that. That's where I have a hard time saying, yeah, that's part of confidentiality. So does that step not change anything of them going and witnessing it themselves? And then, of course, there's the public decency place. But
well, there's something very, very visceral about learning that they did go do that, you know, mm-hmm. but at the same time, you have an obligation to investigate the claims of your client. So it's one thing to say, this guy's insane, he told us this, but we got to go verify if it's even true. You know, it's pretty serious piece of information. But the fact that they investigated it and knew about this and actually confirmed it, as shocking as it is, it doesn't negate the confidentiality of the information anymore. It all begins and ends with the only reason you were able to go find that stuff is because of what you were told. And the fact that you confirmed it is just an extension of your investigation of Garrow's defense. Therefore, it's all protected. You know, on the other end, it's fruit of the poisonous tree. If a piece of evidence is bad or the search is bad, everything falls. This knowledge and confirmation of the location of these bodies is fruit of the poisonous tree under the confidentiality deal. So I think, as shocking as it is, yet again, it shows how important and paramount the courts view that confidentiality.
So talk to me like I'm five, Jarrett, please, and tell me, like, how does this information, best case scenario, how does this information help him in the insanity plea? Like, could you, as an attorney, bring that up in his criminal proceedings in that trial? Like,
so if part of his insanity plea was, I am compelled to kill because I hear voices, or I have been driven so insane by my history. My history was this: I was horribly abused. I then raped and sexually assaulted. I graduated to murder because I black out. I have all these episodes where I am not in control. I cannot appreciate whether or not my actions are lawful or right or wrong. And this is not a one-off. You know, I've done this before. Here's where the bodies are. I think that's how it came out. How it would play out in a courtroom is, if he's going to be counseled by a psychiatrist, which he would have to be, and that psychiatrist gets on the stand and he's saying Garrow blacks out, or Garrow's history shows a pattern of this kind of behavior, he's compelled by voices, whatever it was, that history becomes relevant because it's no longer a whodunit. It's, is this guy nuts? Mm-hmm. So if I'm talking to you like you're five, the question is this guy crazy and how crazy? And if he's so crazy, has he done it before? That's how I would explain it to you if you weren't the astute true crime expert that you are, John. Well, that's what I would say.
I appreciate you. I guess I'm wondering, like, if that does have to come out in court, are there charges able to be filed, and could those be indicted and go through the process at the same time as what he's already there for? If that makes any sense, like, because justice is deserved for them too, even if it is part of his insane.
Absolutely, that would be a separate proceeding. So he would not get a blanket insanity on all of those cases. You would have to go back, review those deaths, review those cases. And then, again, now it's not good if he was deemed insane. Let's just say he lost that argument, too, by the way. He was not deemed insane. He was found sane and he was convicted. But the reality is, but that's a good question, John. It's like, it's not like a proffer where he comes in and this information comes out and he has this blanket of insanity protection, or the fact that he just told a psychiatrist and it came out in this case. Could it then lead to additional charges for these bodies? Yes, it could, and it should. And that is a separate proceeding. It's a separate jurisdiction altogether, too.
Right. So, again, let's pretend like, you know, you're his attorney, you're his defense. He tells you this, but it doesn't come up in court, and he's found guilty or, you know, whatever happens to the original case. At that point, what do you personally do with that information? Is it just sealed in your vault and it doesn't do anything, or do you feel inclined to bring it up somehow that there would be charges for him down the road?
It's sealed in your vault, believe it or not. And that's that duty of confidentiality. You take it to your grave. That's basically what it is. So as hard of a pill as that is to swallow for the families and the reality of how this played out, the lawyers are under no obligation. In fact, they're under an obligation to maintain the confidentiality of that information, even beyond the walls of that courtroom. So this is not one of those results that make you feel better. It's one of those results that's designed to provide the best defense for someone who finds themselves in the situation of Robert Garrow, who's killing multiple people in multiple states, allegedly maybe even Canada, multiple countries, right? So, and you start to say to yourself, like, the law is designed to protect these guys, you know? But at the same time, really what you're protecting isn't him from prosecution of those crimes. It's the right to a defense. That's really what the paramount protection is here. Nobody wants to do this. Nobody wants to give him this right. But we all look at that constitutional right and say it's just so paramount.
I totally get that. And to some degree, I respect it, because I don't want to get into the details now, but I've had to speak with attorneys through what I do and personal life. And I love that I can just be completely frank, all cards on the table with my attorney. It's perfect. It's what needs to happen. I live in a world where I'm under the duty to report situations. So it's such a dichotomy, right? Like, you have the duty to confidentiality. I have to tell people, like, everything you say is, could be used against you, basically.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and I think where we come in, where we have to report is a continuing crime, a continuing harm. And I think that makes somewhat common sense, although a lot of stuff in the law does not make sense. But if someone said to you, like, came in and said, I'm going to kill my husband tomorrow or next week, that is not protected by the attorney-client privilege. If there is a continuing crime where people are being victimized, that's not protected by the attorney-client privilege. If you're using the relationship to further commit a crime, like there's a conspiracy between you and your lawyer where you're committing a crime together, that's not protected. So there are things that it's a little more nuanced sometimes than people think. You know, I do some public work too, where I represent public institutions, that a lot of what we have is subject to right to know requests, for example. And sometimes people think if I'm copied on an email, well, that automatically makes it attorney-client privilege. It does not. Mm-hmm. The fact that I'm on an email with 25 other people doesn't give it some kind of a protection. Actually, it has to be an attorney-client confidential communication between just us together. If there's the presence of a third party who is not a client and the matter is not legal in nature, it's not going to have that protection.
I think we need to change the way that we email you now, then. I thought we were in a certain space. So what happens if they do break that confidentiality? What are the ramifications for attorneys who do say things they shouldn't say on A, themselves, but B, does that open the door for appeals in the case? Like, what happens if they had come forward with that information?
Well, it spells trouble for Mr. Garrow. Not that anybody gives a shit, right? But to the
do you hear him, John? I think we lost your audio.
Hot ethical soup. Okay, if they came forward and breached that privilege and that confidentiality, they could be brought up on ethical charges, and that could result in some kind of a discipline of your law license, including disbarment. Mm-hmm. And nobody wants that, right?
Right, right.
I was going to ask you if there had been any examples in your professional life, but you can't tell us that.
I mean, you can give us a yes or no. Are there still things in your vault?
I've had situations where lawyers have claimed privilege. You know, 20 years is a long time to be doing this. And I've had situations where lawyers have claimed privilege with regard to matters we've been able to get around it, but they were largely procedural, nothing of this nature. And then we had inappropriate relationships with lawyers and clients where that kind of thing. You had to kind of pierce the veil of the attorney-client privilege, but I was always able to back it into some exception, like the presence of a third party that's not an investigator or a paralegal or something, where we were able to get around it. I've certainly had people improperly raise the privilege as a shield of us getting information, and we've been able to get around it, but nothing this egregious.
Yeah, I think I watch the show Blue Bloods all the time. I don't know if you're familiar, but everyone is just super, they are for the law, but they also have just a great moral conscience. So I think if I'm Garrow's attorney, I'm going to be like, you need to talk to this therapist and tell them what you told me, because maybe the therapist has the duty to report, but your hands are out of it, you know?
Well, but the other thing is you just can't. So that therapist wouldn't even have a duty at that point. And that's a great point. Like, think about the HIPAA laws in this country, too, right? That we have, I mean, really, we go above and beyond to try to protect our health information. And that's something a lot of people are very private about and don't want necessarily public. So if Garrow, in preparation of his defense, told the therapist this, and he would likely have told the psychiatrist this, it's protected in a sense, like his lawyers aren't relieved of that duty, but the therapist, in assessing his sanity, could address it.
Right.
But the therapist couldn't necessarily call the families, which is really what was being asked here. Like, mm-hmm. Notify the authorities, call the families. I think their rights are begin and end at that. Is it an imminent threat? Is there a future harm to someone?
Right. This is really interesting, man. I really appreciate like you coming on and talking about this, even though it wasn't the answer I wanted to hear. I can still respect it.
And in the 2026, like this happened 45 years ago. It happens today. The attention this would get would be, I think, insane. Do you think it plays out any differently if the media is what it is today instead of 1980 or whenever it happened?
Well, it was a pretty big deal considering. Yeah. I mean, this was a huge story. But I mean, I wasn't around. But
so you're not that much older than us. I was a kid.
It was a pretty big deal. But yeah, I think that just looking at how scrutinized cases get and you know, you guys and I get into cases well beyond our jurisdictions, you know. So, yeah, I think this is something that would really get a lot of attention. You know, look at the minutiae and the examination of like Karen Reed and her lawyers.
Yeah.
And everything that was known and what was known there, what was going on there, things of that nature, like with Alan Jackson and some of the work they were doing, like that case played out every day, you know, live on television and across the internet. I would imagine if you're wrestling with an attorney-client privilege in a case of that magnitude, this would be a huge, huge issue.
Oh, Jared, I do have another question. So as a prosecutor, help me remember if this is correct. If you find a piece of evidence that you plan to bring against the defendant, you have to let the defense know about, you have to disclose that, correct?
Yes. Yes. Under the rules of discovery, if you have a piece of evidence that you would be utilizing in a case, 99.9% of the time, that's given to the other side. Now, if you had a statement or something you planned on using in rebuttal, very limited exception, maybe you can withhold it. But you have a right to confront the witnesses and evidence against you. So it's never trial by surprise. No, although on television, people may act shocked or surprised at what comes in. There should not be a lot of surprises in a trial.
Do you, as a defense attorney, have any similar disclosure law or rules that you have to follow? Like if you found a piece of evidence?
No, not necessarily. So there is a reciprocal discovery request that gets filed from prosecutors where basically you're saying, I gave you my cards, you got to give me what you got. Really, that applies to expert testimony. You can't come in with an expert at the last minute that we're not given an opportunity to rebut. That wouldn't be fair. You know, and anytime anyone's tried to do that with me, I would always say, Judge, the same thing. It's not trial by surprise. You know, I can't get Pearl Harbored here. I got to have an opportunity to answer it. So when it comes to things of that nature, yes, they have to give them. But I promise you, if a defense is going to put a defense on, if there's going to be a surprise, it's usually coming from their side. You know, they'll say, oh, we learned this in trial prep or something. The prosecution side is usually much better versed on complying with discovery. So theirs is not as stringent as ours, but there is a reciprocal discovery request made. And this, again, when you're in the middle of a trial and the defense raises something, maybe they didn't tell you before or provide you with a statement, there are a couple exceptions and off ramps they could use in getting around that.
Okay. I was wondering about, like, if the defense wanted to bring cell phone data, I was wondering if that would have to be disclosed ahead of time so that you have a chance to review it before it's even presented.
Typically
to the court.
Something of that nature, yes.
Okay.
That would be something because, again, that is more of a scientific piece of evidence. I would hope that they would share that information with the other side. But states vary on this. Like in Pennsylvania, a judge would not be happy if I was involved with a case a couple weeks ago. I got a call from a lawyer, and the woman was saying to me, like, oh, it's going to cause a delay if I give these cell phone records or these text messages. I'm like, wait a minute. They're text messages between the victim and your client. Like, they should have your victim's text messages. Like, mm-hmm. Ask them first. And why don't they if they don't? Like, so, and they were within the time frame of the crime. So, but it is always smarter to share that information because a surprise the risk with a surprise is it gets suppressed or it causes a delay in your case, and you don't want that.
Right. Okay.
Yeah. Now, this is all super in the weeds stuff that I think is really helpful for us to understand a lot of our cases, not just this one. But yeah, you're right. It's certainly
like a constitutional law class, guys. This is law like 201.
I love it. I want to like go back to school.
You should.
Tell me about your book. Jamie seems to know about it, but somehow I'm under a rock. So,
Mothers, Murders, and Motivation, A Journey Through the Heart and Mind of a Prosecutor.
Yes. So the book is coming out on April 21st. So for Mother's Day, I've been saying, if you love your mother and your mother loves murder, this is the book for you, right? But this book is, I'm an Italian mama's boy, right? So the book is about my mom. And my mom raised, I'm the youngest of four boys. So she raised us on her own for a long time, but we lost our dad when I was just seven. So my mom went out, worked her tail off, raised us, came home and cooked at night, and just fought like hell for us. Eventually remarried to our stepdad, Charlie, who was an amazing guy. So she didn't do it 100% on her own, but we used to tease her and say, Ma, how are we ever going to repay you for everything you did for us? And she used to say to us, when you see a mom that needs help, you help her. And these are the cases over the course of my 20 years where I fought for a mom who lost a child. You guys certainly know the Brittany Drexel case. Mm-hmm. I represented Dawn Drexel down in South Carolina in her decade-long search for Brittany. So that's what this book is about. It's about just one mom who took care of her boys, and one of those boys went on to prosecute a lot of people who hurt moms. And that's what the book's about. And that my motivation was always my mom. And really, that's our story. So it's five of the cases I had over the course of my career that I highlight. And the moms were center stage in those cases. And really, it's dedicated to those moms too. And of course, you guys know the Hugo Selinsky case. Mrs. Krakowski, Michael Krakowski's mother, waited so long for justice and really stood by our side for so long and was so patient. And there's a portion of the book, a significant portion of the book, that's about that case as well.
Bro, that is incredible. That is an incredible idea. So shout out to your mother. Raised a heck of a son, and that's a great way to just say thank you, Mom. I love that. I love that.
Yeah, so she's 79 now. There's a foot of snow here in Pennsylvania. She's down in Florida. but, you know, I talked to her today, but she's excited. And really, I wanted to tell her story. I think this is a story of hope for people, you know, and I think we were not special people. We didn't have big money. We didn't have any. It was like But this tough woman, you know, from this tough woman, you know, this little boy grows up and he helped people. And you know, again, none of it's earth shattering, but it's very special. And I'm proud of it. I just literally finished it 2 days ago. So if you guys write a book, it's very therapeutic. I don't know if you've gone down this road yet, but the book is, we received the interior of the book this week. So we're actually looking at what it's going to look like in print. And I keep finding little mistakes and they're going to kill me. My editor's going to kill me because I'm like, hey, could you change this? They're like, this thing's locked in. It's already on Amazon. Like, what are you doing?
If you do an audiobook and you need a Southern guy to read it, just holler at me. If you want someone that sounds educated, holler at Jamie or, you know.
No, so I started to read it to do the audio stuff and I get choked up as I'm reading. I'm like, I'm not going to be. I'm an emotional basket case. How am I going to do this? You know, but I want to do it in my voice,
it,
you know.
It needs to be.
So we'll see.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I'm sure that would take a lot of time to get through. And I know the two cases you mentioned are two we've talked to you about. And one, you're prosecuting an individual who hurt some moms, and the other, you were Brittany's mom's advocate. And I just think not even a dichotomy, because both are in the pursuit of justice and supporting moms, but just the various ways you've been able to do it. Just really impressive and a theme that I wouldn't have put together without probably this conversation in this book.
Well, you know what? I didn't even intend to write a book about moms. I've often spoken about my mom, mm-hmm. but when I sat down and looked at the cases, I'm like, wow, there's like five moms in these. You know, I was looking at like 10 mm-hmm. or 15 cases. I would eventually want to write about all of them and talk about many of them. But I'm like, there's a theme here, you know, and my mom used to follow my cases. She'd show up in the courtroom sometimes and sit in the back, and those were the ones that really jumped out at her, too. She would love that, you know, whenever I was, because I'd always tell her, you know, Ma, this case reminds me of you, you know, or something like that. But one of the cases, guys, interestingly enough, a mother was put on trial for the murder of her child, a three-month-old baby. The mom's boyfriend killed the baby, and mom had been warned not to have the baby around this particular individual. And not only warned, it was part of a safety plan that our Children and Youth Services put in place. She breached the safety plan, and what do you think happens? You know, boyfriend sure. kills baby. We prosecuted the boyfriend, then put mom on trial for manslaughter. And although there were a lot of people who felt like it was the right thing to do, a lot of people thought, well, you know, Ferrantino stepped on it this time. He's never going to get her. She didn't touch the kid. How's he going to get her for manslaughter? I was asking myself the same thing sometimes, too, because it was kind of a novel situation. But we got her. And not to do a spoiler, but that is in the book, too. And I was becoming a father during that case. You know, I had babies myself. So I never in my life thought I'd be doing baby murder cases. I always thought, like, I'd be doing different kind of stuff. And I ended up doing a couple of those, and they kill you. I mean, they tear you up. I'm out of the business now, you know, over a year, and I still think about those. But I was happy to be able to tell that story. Like, that's not the kind of case you're going to see on Netflix, but it's an important story. And I think that those kinds of cases don't get, and those, that kind of work of prosecutors doesn't get enough attention.
And man, I see that crap every single day. So yeah, I talk to people all the time, and I've said that very same thing. Like, I can't believe more of this stuff isn't on the news, you know, just because of how awful it is. But
because nobody wants to talk about babies getting hurt, you know, and I use that theme. You know, I was blessed with this amazing mom, and I'm going to hold bad ones accountable. You know, she's going to be the measuring stick for them. And that's what that part of the book is about, too. So. But I, like I said, it was therapeutic to write it. It took about a year and a half to get everything done, but I'm really happy with it. And when it comes out, you know, I'd be happy to come back on and talk to you. I want to hear your reaction to it if you get the chance to read it.
I want to read it. Also, I want to know, has your mom read it yet? I know you just finished it up a couple of days ago.
Well, she knows all the nice things I say about her. I don't think there's any surprises there. The only one who's read it, my wife read it. Very recently, and she said, she knows all these stories, but she said it's different to read it in print. You know, she was there, God bless her, by my side. We were engaged when I got to the DA's office. So Nicole was very much, you know, in the background of all those cases. So she knows the stories. But, you know, when you see it in print and all these years later, it kind of brings those emotions back. So yeah. She read it. And another friend read it, and they all say the same thing. It starts off, you know, this nice little boy who loves his mom, and it gets dark and it gets crazy, you know. But in the end, there's some vindication, I promise.
I want to interview your mama after she has a chance to read it. Like, first, let's start off. Tell me some little Jarrett stories, but then tell me how proud you are of them. You know, that's
really cool. Oh, she would love it. She would love it. Believe me. And I said, we want to do some interviews. And I said, Ma, we're going to go to the Good Morning America people. And I said, when I go to those people, I'm going to bring you to them. I'm going to say, you're the only ones that are going to get Mom. Right. And I said, but you know what? True Crime Cast is going to get Mom. Yeah, fair enough. Because they asked for it.
Fair we'll enough. Take it.
If we could be just the caveat, that'd be great.
Yeah. The book is available for pre-order on Books A Million, Barnes & Noble, Target, Walmart, and Amazon. And we'll put links to all that in the show notes, published by Simon & Schuster. So that's how you know it's top-notch. This is, really excited about this. Really excited about the three stories that are in here that you haven't told us yet. So once those are out in the world, maybe we'll dive a little deeper into them as well.
I would love to.
Yeah. Awesome.
All right, Jarrett, thank you so much, man. We really appreciate you.
Thanks for your time and your insight.
Thank you, John and Jamie. Always a pleasure, guys.